God himself is present. Did Jesus sing this morning? We did that song. What did we discover this morning that God wasn't present? What would that do to us? Would it be possible that one of us would sin that God's presence would not be with us? Thoughts that I enjoyed our Sunday school class, thoughts that came there. Some of those I plan to look at this morning. This morning in the adult Sunday school class, the very first question was, why did the sin of one man cause defeat in battle? Would it be possible this morning, if someone here is living in sin, would cause defeat in our congregation? I looked at that question for quite a while earlier this week, and I gave some deep thought. And the title of the message this morning is The Choice of One Man. I guess you could say the choice of one man as well, everybody, but specifically the choice of one man. The profound effect of a choice or a man, what that can do to people is what divides them. Now, I've often struggled with that. When you see people that make choices, maybe a dad who deserts his family or makes some terrible choices, and the family is left to fend for themselves, what you just fill in the blanks. Tremendous effect that can have. The choice of one man. Aiken's family suffered terrible consequences here. There was innocent soldiers that lost their lives because of his choice. But even broader than that, look out across history, we see men who made decisions that affected millions of people. Millions of people. And when communism came to power, and Stalin took power in Russia, he used food shortage as a political tool, causing millions of deaths. Hitler sent millions of people to the torture and death chambers. The founder of the People's Republic of China, in his 27-year rule, says his policies led to the deaths of between 40 and 80 million people. You can't even wrap your mind around that. Tremendous effects that their decisions, their selfish agenda, whatever it might have been. Or you can flip that over. There's people who do tremendous good. The choices of one man. Think of the Apostle Paul. I mean, he spent hours and days and weeks and years teaching and preaching and traveling. Suffered tremendously. Churches were established all over the place because of one man. Think of some other people. Sir Alexander Fleming discovered penicillin. Imagine today when we get an infection, we're not purified because we have an infection because there's antibiotics, right? There's penicillin, there's other things that we can. But because of that one man's discovery, a tremendous amount of lives have been saved. Another person that was really interesting, Edward Jenner. He was the first one to discover how vaccines or immunization could work, specifically about smallpox. At the time that he lived, 10% of the world's population died of smallpox. And in certain areas where it became more, it spread rapidly or whatever, up to 20% of the population would die. Just picture that. If this year, 2025, 25% of the population of Owasso would die. Or 25% of us sitting here this morning, that's one in five. He could have said, well, you know, I haven't died of it yet. But no, he saw the need. He saw the need. He said, we've got to fix this. We've got to figure this out. He was willing to try to come up with a remedy or a solution to this problem. Well, obviously, there's many, many more examples of what one man can do for good or for evil. But I'd like to look in the Bible this morning. This concept of one man is mentioned a number of times in the Bible, and probably one of the most notable ones is in John 11. You want to turn with me for just... I'm going to tell you right now that my sermon this morning is in one of those neat packages with six nice points and subheadings. So if you're taking notes this morning, I encourage you to take notes, but it is not as neat and tidy as it is sometimes. And I worked long and hard to try to button up some of these different ways I wanted to go with this message. But I have a burden this morning, and I'm going to try to share it, but I'm going to be jumping around a little bit in the Bible and looking at a number of scriptures. John chapter 11, the setting here is Lazarus was brought back to life, and this had made a tremendous impact. And the Jews were talking about it. We break into the story here, verse 45 of John 11. Then many of the Jews which came to Mary and had seen the things that Jesus did believed on him. But some of them went their way to the Pharisees and told them what things Jesus had done. Then gathered the chief priests and the Pharisees to counsel and said, what do we do for this man who has many miracles? If we let thus alone, all men will believe on him, and the Romans shall come and take away both our place and nation. And one of the named Caiaphas, being the high priest that same year, said unto them, ye know nothing at all, nor consider that it is expedient for us that this one man should die for the people, than that the whole nation perish not. Caiaphas makes a startling remark. It just, he says this, he said, by the way, you guys don't know anything. Let me speak to you. He goes and he says this, that it is basically what he's saying, that it is expedient for this one man to die rather than the whole nation shall perish. And he was focusing on verse 48. He said, if we leave Jesus alone, we let him go over this teaching, all men are going to follow him. The Romans are going to come and they're going to take away our place and nation. In other words, our temple or whatever. It was going to have an effect on them. Very interesting, at this council of the Jewish leaders, they took a serious shift in their outlook in Jesus. Up until now, they had been perturbed by his teachings, they had been jealous, they had been threatened by him, but they take a serious shift and they openly plan to kill him with the concept that if one man should die, it's better for him to die than that their nation be destroyed. And having no idea that their evil plot was exactly what God was going to use to fulfill his great redemption plan. Very, very interesting to me how Caiaphas prophesied. It goes on, it says that he did not realize. Verse 51, and this spake he not of himself, but being the high priest of that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation. Very, very interesting point about one man. Well, going on to Romans 5, There's 10 different times in Romans 5 where it talks about one man or the offense of one. And I want to look at a few of those as well. So Romans 5, verse 12 through 19. Notice as I read through this, I'm not going to make a lot of comments. I just want us to grasp the effect of one. Notice how many times it talks about one as I read these verses. Romans 5, verse 12. Wherefore, as by one man, it's talking about Adam, sin entered into the world, and death by sin, and so death passed upon all men, for that all have sinned. For until the law, sin was in the world, but sin is not imputed when there is no law. Nevertheless, death reigned from Adam to Moses, even over them that had not sinned after the similitude of Adam's transgression, who is a figure of him that was to come. But not as the offense, so also is the free gift. For if through the offense of one many be dead, much more the grace of God and the gift by grace, which is by one man, Jesus Christ, hath abounded to many. And not as if it was by one that sinned, so is the gift of the judgment was by one to condemnation, but the free gift is of many offenses and justification. For if by one man's offense death reigned by one, much more they which receive abundance of grace and the gift of righteousness shall reign in the life by one, Jesus Christ. Therefore, as by the defense of one judgment came upon all men to condemnation, even so by the righteousness of one, the free gift came from all men unto justification of life. Verse 19 kind of wraps it up. Whereas by one man's disobedience, many were made sinners, so by the obedience of one shall many be made righteous. So this passage in Romans is clearly conveying the fact that sin came in the world by one person. Jesus was a remedy of sin. And there is a spiritual war and a battle going on one side or the other. Sin against victory, victory against sin. I find it interesting that the Jewish leaders had no idea what they had just put into motion. Rather, they were so fixated on preserving their nation or their temple or their, you fill in the blanks. They were not willing to see Jesus as this one Messiah that he would save the people. Well, this morning, the goal of the message is to challenge all of us to deeply think about how we look at life's situations and what effect our decisions have on us and those around us. To look beyond the here and the now and look at the bigger picture, both individually and as a congregation. I think we need to look beyond the here and the now. And recognize the choice of even one man can make a huge difference for good or evil. And realize that we are fighting the Lord's army, fighting for his cause. I'd like to go back in the Old Testament now, 1 Samuel 17. I look at some foundational truths in that account. And I figure most of you realize that 1 Samuel 17 is the story of David and Goliath. And I would like to look at a number of things here beyond the sensational story of David and Goliath. Okay? Look into more of the character of Saul and David and the political scene that was there. What has brought them to this point? And reach and look at a few serious concepts that I believe that this chapter will bring out. There's a lot more going on than simply the death of a giant. And that's what I'd like to focus on this morning. The key phrase that I would like to look at is found in verse 29 of 1 Samuel 17. So David says these profound words. Is there not a cause? Is there not a cause? He asked that question. In those five words, David clearly shows that he is aware that there are much deeper issues at stake. And that is precisely why he was willing to go fight Goliath when no one else would. But before we really look deeply into chapter 17, I would like to go back and look at some events that led up to this to help us understand what was really going on here. And this is where, when I started digging into, starting in chapter 10 to chapter 17, there's a lot of years that have elapsed, and there's so many things that have been happening here. And I feel that they're very important, and they point towards the situation that was brought to a climax in chapter 17. And it's hard to know how much to read and how much to look at. But we're going to attempt to look at some of the preceding chapters, just little snatches out of each chapter as we go through here that led to the situation that we're in chapter 17. So chapter 10, we notice Samuel takes a vial of oil, he anoints Saul to be king. I'm kind of just going to tell the story. I'm not going to necessarily read word for word some of these things, but very common, we understand a lot of things that are going on here. Saul is anointed, and I'd like to really look at verse 9, where it says, and it was so that when he had turned, this is Samuel, turned his back to go, sorry, Saul had turned his back to go from Samuel, that God gave him another heart, and all those signs came to pass that day. So everything that Samuel said was going to happen, happened. And I'm sure I've noticed that before, but it really just stuck to me again that God had given him, Saul, a new heart. And with this new heart, he embraced God's will and his desire to destroy the enemies of God. And very shortly thereafter, he meets up with a group of prophets, one of the very next verses. And he starts to prophesy. This was evidence of his new heart. Verse 11 says, it came to pass when all that knew him before time saw that, behold, he prophesied among the prophets. Then the people said to one another, what is this that has come upon the son of Kish? Is Saul also among the prophets? So the people that had known Saul before this started to recognize something changed. Something is different. They were surprised and amazed that Saul was prophesying and he had a new heart. Chapter 11, the Ammonites come up and they threaten these people, the Jabesh Gilead, and Saul gets wind of this. And notice verse 6 says, and the Spirit of God came upon Saul when he heard those tidings, and his anger was kindled. He had a righteous indignation. He said, this is not okay. We need to do something about it. Fascinating, the interesting tactic he uses there. He takes the yoke of oxen, he hews them up in pieces, and he sends them throughout the nation of Israel. He says, come join the battle. We need to do this. And they had a tremendous victory. Tremendous victory that they experienced at that time. The point that I'm trying to make here is that Saul was clearly chosen by God. God had given him a new heart and filled him with the Spirit of God. He was fully equipped to fulfill what God wanted him to do. In chapter 12, Samuel again reminds the people that he is old and he will soon pass away from that scene. He's going to be less and less involved, and Saul is going to lead out. And he reminds the people, he says, listen, I never recommended that you should get a king. That God has taken care of you through the Egypt experience, through the wilderness experience, through Moses' time. God was faithful to you without a king. But you asked for one, and you're going to have one. And then in chapter 13, it appears like Samuel just kind of steps out of the scene, and Saul takes over and says he starts to reign there. And almost immediately, things start to fall apart. You really, and I don't have time to look at each of those. I studied it and I read it, but we don't have time this morning to look at it deeply. But things start to fall apart, and I asked myself the question as I was saying, why? What was going on? Here was Saul, was equipped. He had the tools he needed. He had the Spirit of God. What was going on? But it appears that he made some very foolish mistakes that cost him the favor of God and the men around him. And you almost see him becoming desperate. There's a lot of years that have elapsed in some of these chapters, but we see Saul becoming desperate, and he needs to go up against this army. We know this story very well. And he's waiting for Samuel to come and to offer. And it says that Saul forces himself, I love that term, forces himself to perform the sacrifice to God when he grows tired of waiting for Samuel. Samuel shows up and tells him how foolish this was, and that because of that choice, his kingdom will not continue through his lineage. It will go to someone else. Chapter 14 starts with a focus on Jonathan. Bible scholars would say Jonathan was only 15 years old when that story took place. But it's interesting that it almost would appear that Jonathan would have been more capable of leading the army than his dad. His dad is sitting under a tree. I'm not sure why he was sitting there. Said he was under a pomegranate tree. And Jonathan takes the initiative, and he goes up against the Philistines. He talks to God, and he is willing to go up against them with only his armor bearer to help him. And has a stunning and decisive victory. And again, I'm trying to portray that Saul is making some very foolish mistakes. Saul makes this thing, he says, okay, today no one may eat and if they do, they will die. What was the point of that? I have no still don't know why he decided to do that. Someone already thought that that would bring the blessing of God upon them. Jonathan does not hear this. He eats. And in verse 44, of chapter 14, Saul says, God, you so more also, for thou shalt surely die, Jonathan. He said, because you ate, you're going to die. And the people said, absolutely not. They stood in the way, and they kept Saul from doing this foolish thing of killing his son. And then, verse 46 is kind of an interesting verse. It says, then Saul went up with all the Philistines, and the Philistine went to their own place. So here they have been in the midst of conquering these nations, in the midst of going up against the Philistines, and suddenly, after this event with Jonathan, Saul just packs up and goes home. And I think there's a lot more in that verse than we realize. I think somehow he just realized that the people weren't following him. He did not have their hearts. And he said, you know what, we're just going to go home. We're just going to whisper. But that was not what God had intended. And you kind of see that through Saul's life, the ups and the downs. Today's language, you probably would say he was bipolar. It's probably what we would label him with. Because one day he would do something, and the next day it was very unpredictable. It was very, very next verse. But again, I'm not sure how much time had elapsed between some of these verses. Verse 47, it says, Saul took the kingdom over Israel and fought against all enemies on every side. Here he again is fighting. He's trying to do. He gathers hosts. He's going up against these nations. He's doing exactly what God had told him to do. He's trying to destroy these evil nations. Satan is being defeated. Idol worshippers are being killed. And he is following the assignment given by God. Suddenly he's doing this again. Let's read verse 52 of verse 14. And I think there's a lot implied in this verse to help us to understand who Saul was. And it says, and there was sore war against the Philistines all the days of Saul. And when Saul saw any strong man or any valiant man, he took him unto himself. What I take from that verse is that Saul started to focus on building up his army, getting more, like he was looking for skill, for size, for men of valor instead of for God's blessing. He was building up his army from a materialistic point of view instead of following the Lord God. And Samuel shows up in chapter 15, and I truly believe that this chapter 15 situation was a test for Saul. Samuel comes to him and gives him an assignment. He gives him a very explicit detail of what he's supposed to do. I truly believe that a test to see if Saul is ready to completely obey God. As we all know, Saul fails this test. He keeps the enemy alive. And he keeps the best of the flock. In direct disobedience to God, what he had said. Samuel confronts him, and guess what Saul does? He tries to blame the people. This is another sign of a weak leader. Blame shifting. Verse 26 of verse 15. If that's when God officially rejects Saul from being king. I believe up until that time, Saul could have chosen to do what was right and be accepted by God. But in this situation now, in chapter 15, verse 26, it says, Samuel said unto Saul, I will not return with thee, for thou hast rejected the word of the Lord, and the Lord hath rejected thee from being king of Israel. Really sad verse there, where it's very, very clear that God had rejected him from being king. Chapter 16 starts with Samuel being told to go anoint one of the sons of Jesse. And immediately after he does this, probably one of the saddest words in this account is found in verse 14. It says, for the Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and an evil spirit from the Lord troubled him. I don't know what, it'd be interesting to have a discussion on what that evil spirit of the Lord was. I believe there simply could possibly have been simply a guilty conscience. He realized that God had chosen him, God had given him in explicit details of what to do, and now he chose not to. He had a guilty conscience. David is anointed king, but goes back to herding sheep. And Saul goes on trying to lead a nation without the Spirit of God present. Tremendous task for him to do. Now that brings us to chapter 17 that I'd like to look at. Interesting enough, if you look at the chronological Bible, 25 years have elapsed since chapter 14 to chapter 17. David wasn't even born when some of these happened in the preceding chapters. And a lot of things obviously have happened that we don't have record of. Needless to say, word must have gotten back to the Philistines that not all was well in God's kingdom. It's interesting to me, the Philistines seem to recognize that the children of Israel had a God that they were serving. Remember that when they had gone to battle a long time ago, when Eli's sons had taken the Ark of the Covenant with, they took that Ark of the Covenant thinking that they had got Israel's God and that gave them power. Interesting that one of the commentaries I read would have said that giant Goliath was actually the one that had killed Eli's sons and was responsible to take that ark back to the country. The Bible doesn't say that. That was an interesting little side note. But anyway, chapter 17, the Philistines show up and they challenge the Israelite army. And I believe that this was more than just a military maneuver. They were actually going up against the Israelites and challenging the God they served. They were challenging and rebelling against the children of Israel. I believe that there was more at stake than just a desire to take over the land of the Israelites. I believe this was a direct attack on God and his people. Satan was taking advantage of the situation. I think sometimes we don't realize that in some of the conflicts that go on, or how much Satan is behind it. Saul musters up his army and he shows up on the opposite side of the valley. And there they wait, terrified, too terrified to do anything. It's just, I don't know if there's anywhere else that you ever read in the Bible where two armies came together but didn't fight. It says, if you read chapter 17, I don't think we have time to read the whole chapter. But every day they would come out and they would get into formation. They would get into formation, but it doesn't sound like they ever went into battle. What was going on here? Well, I believe that the Philistines realized that the Israelites had a superior army. I think it was more Israelites. Because if you read it, the years leading up to this, how many times they had victory and had really destroyed many of the Philistines. They realized that the Israelites were stronger. And that is precisely why they brought Goliath out with those mocking words. Let's read verse 24 of chapter 17. It says, and all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were sore afraid. That was the whole point of bringing Goliath out, was to intimidate them and to keep them from coming to fight. And Goliath would come out there and he would say, I defy the army of Israel. And he would come out there and do that for 40 days. In verse 4, we notice the word champion. It's an interesting word that they use to describe Goliath. It's interesting that David never used that word. He never considered him a champion. But that was their champion. And they were using him. They were kind of hiding behind him. Both sides lacked the courage to actually get out there and fight. So Goliath makes this challenge to fight one-on-one. Again, I don't know if you can ever read in history that there ever was a war where the outcome of the war would have been decided by a one-on-one combat or a duel as such. It was a very unusual way of conducting a fight. And I'm not sure how serious Goliath was, because obviously when he was killed, they didn't follow through with it. The terms that he had introduced when he was killed, the Philistines should have automatically become the servants of Saul and his men. It's pretty obvious that he never expected them to take him up on the challenge. So how they were ever going to bring this to close, I'm not sure. But neither the Philistine army nor the Israelite army was brave enough to attack. Verse 10 and 11, and the Philistine said, I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together. When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistines, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. What a sad state of affairs. Why did these men forget the tremendous victories that God had given them over and over again in the past? Why did no one think about falling on their face before God like Joshua did in the story today in our Sunday school lesson? Along comes David. David shows up on an errand from his father's house. To me, it's interesting that David had spent time in Saul's house before this, playing the harp, trying to help this bipolar man be sane. But then had gone back when the army, when the war started, and his four brothers had shown up. And so he's there, and out steps Goliath. And David immediately notices this. He's like, what's going on here? You notice that in verse 25. In verse 25, David takes notice of what's going on. So then the men of Israel said, have you seen this man that has come up? Surely if you defy Israel, he can come up, and he shall be that the man who killeth him, the king will enrich him with great riches, and will give his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel. And verse 26 goes on, and David spake to the man that stood by him, saying, what shall be done to the man that killeth this Philistine, and take away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? David asked the question, the most obvious question that they should all have been considering. Who is going to take away the reproach of Israel? Who is going to stand up for God? Who is going to do this? Like, what are we waiting for? How can we let this heathen, idol worshiping man defy the God in heaven? Why are we letting him defy us? Who is going to stand up for God? That's the question he's asking. It's interesting, David's oldest brother's response. Verse 28, Eliab, his oldest brother, heard when he spake unto the man. Eliab's anger was kindled against David and said, why camest thou hither? With whom hast thou left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know that pride, the naughtiness of thine heart, thou art come down that thou mightest see this to battle. You know what? That's a really typical carnal response. You realize that? Like, why are you here? What do you have to do with this? And I think David, this just shows to me that he truly had a heart after God. He just looks at him and says, what have I done? What did I do? Is there not a cause? He goes right back and he focuses on that phrase. Is there not a cause? Isn't there a reason that we should be worked up? We should be dealing with this situation. In his mind, there was an obvious need. And there was an obvious thing that needed to be done. I don't think for 1 minute he was doing it for the reward. Rather, he was doing it to defend the cause of God. Why? Because he was a man after God's own heart. Well, the question that I would like to have ringing in all our minds this morning is this. Do we see the cause? Do we see the cause? Are we aware of what life is all about? I confess, when I look out over the churches today, I wonder, do we have a cause to stand for? Are we just going through the motions? Or do we have a cause? Are we plugged in? Do we know what God's cause is? What are we willing to do for God? You know, 20% of the city of Owasso would be dying tomorrow morning from smallpox. What do we do about it? Brothers and sisters, probably more than 20%. What are we doing about it? What are we willing to give up for God? Can we be like David and see the cause and be willing to be the obvious? You know, if you think about it, Saul was head and shoulders taller than anyone else. He was the obvious person that should have gone out and confronted Goliath. He was the man in charge. Or maybe his son Jonathan. I don't know why Jonathan. Why it happened just that other time when he had that great victory. Why was Jonathan not willing to do it? I don't know the answer to that. The question for us this morning is, whose army are we on anyway? Are we determined to never let anyone defy the living God as they do? I believe that we need to be on the offensive. We need to be, when people say things that's clearly outside of God's teaching, don't be silent. Speak for God. I'm concerned that we're tempted to be more like Saul's army, afraid to go up against the enemy and claim the victory. You know, in that situation, there's thousands and thousands of people there, I believe. All it took was one man to stand up and say, one man. Don't wait on others. Do the right thing. I love the confident words of David in verse 37 and verse 45. Verse 37, David said, "For the Lord that delivered me out of the paw of the lion and out of the paw of the bear, he will deliver me out of the hand of the Philistine." He said, "God helped me other times. Why wouldn't he help me now?" And the reality was that lion and bear was just a material thing, right? He was just trying to protect his sheep. This was, he was going up against this heathen man who was defying the living God. And he says, "I have confidence in this God that he would protect me." Verse 45. Then said David to the Philistine. Well, the Philistine had just made fun of him as this is Goliath. As he pleaded to him, he said, "Hey, come on here and I'll feed you to the buzzards." That's what he's saying. "I'll feed you to the buzzards." And David said to Goliath, "Thou comest to me with a sword and with a spear and with a shield, but I come to thee in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom thou hast defied." He said, "I am going to stand up and defend this God that you defied, and you are going to understand that there is a God." And a lot of victory followed. You know what? Because David was willing to stand up and do the right thing, suddenly all the rest of the Israelites had courage. As soon as Goliath went down, guess what? They all stampeded over there and started fighting. Remember the victory. Brothers and sisters, the world is pressing in on us. What are we going to do about it? And I've heard, I don't know how many conversations I've had in the last year of concerned people about things that are pressing in on us. What are we going to do about it? Can we together face the real issues of life? We're going to need to stand together. We're going to have to be in this together. You know, I believe that Satan wants to get us all mired down and little petty differences and help us lose our focus. We dare not get sidetracked. You know, at times we might look at the environment that we find ourselves in 2025 and be fearful and discouraged. We might choose to try to somehow run away from the circumstance we don't like. We might spend hours worrying about what might still be coming. But I'd like to offer you a better way this morning. And that is the example of David. When he stood all alone and said, "Is there not a cause?" He knew whose cause he was on. David knew whose side he was on. And that is what gave him the courage to stand. David knew what victory felt like. Do you know what victory feels like? Come on, wake up, guys. Seriously. People that are sleeping right now, I'm sorry, but it bothers me. Okay? There is a cause. There is eternity coming. And we need to have the courage to stand up for what's right. Brothers and sisters, the same God that we serve today was the exact same God David stood up for. I want to close with a couple of verses from Hebrews 10 in closing. Hebrews 10, verse 22 through 25. The Hebrew writer says, "Let us draw near with a true heart and full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled from evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. Let us hold fast the profession of our hope without wavering, for he is faithful that promised. Now let us consider one another to provoke into love and good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together as the manner of some is, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as you see the day approaching. Brothers and sisters, there is a way, there is a cause. We can stand together. We can fight the battle. God will give us the victory. Let's pray. Father in heaven, we come before your presence this morning. Thank you so much for your word. Thank you for the gift of one man, Jesus Christ, who is willing to take away the reproach and the sin that came into the world by one man. Father, we just pray that as we go through life, that we can truly be committed to the cause. To the cause of Christ, that we can be awake and alert, and realize that the world is pressing in on us, and we need to stand up and fight against it. Because, Father, there's a generation coming, there's a generation here today with us that needs the power of victory. Father, we just pray that you would help us to be men of courage, men who have a desire to do what's right in the face of any opposition. So just be with us. Bless each of the fathers here to represent their home. Bless everyone that is committed to serving you. Be with anyone who is struggling to know how to best move forward in their lives, so they can just rally around the Lord's army, realize there's a cause and they can stand for that. Thank you for the example of David. He was willing to stand up, fight for your army against incredible odds, knowing that you give the power and strength that it needed. Pray the blessing on this congregation in Jesus' name.